By the time Lynn and I had been married for 2 years, we had travelled over 28,000 miles. We'd driven from Perth to Darwin. Then we headed off back down to the high country of Victoria. We'd had a son and had another baby on the way. The previous 2 years, I had worked in Narangarup, then Perth for a few months, then Karratha, followed by Port Hedland and a few other jobs as well. I couldn't seem to settle down anywhere. Blokes at work would try to be friendly, but I'd have trouble relating and would move on. Once home, I worked in the sawmill at Swifts Creek, driving a forklift. My daughter was born. I did Year 12 English by correspondence, passed, and we moved back to Perth. My application to do a manual arts course at Midlands Teachers College was successful, and in February 1975, I started studying to become a high school teacher. We bought a house in the suburbs, and maybe for once, I started to feel settled. I worked hard as a student and got good results. I seemed to have little time for my family. A familiar routine emerged. Lynn ran the family, the home, and somehow we stayed married. The months and then the years ticked by. When the 6th of August rolled around, 6 years into our marriage, the nightmares and flashbacks returned as usual, like they had all those Augusts before. But in the first years of our marriage, I tried to disappear for a few days around this date. It had been 10 years since that devastating incident in Vietnam, and although I was desperate to stay in control at home, come August, I would fly into rages over the smallest incidents. Then turn to Lynn and bellow, "Don't you know what month it is?" "It's August," my wife would answer, rationally, calmly. I ranted, mumbled, and was frustrated with her. I was never violent, thank God. At her urgings, I tried to explain the significance of the date. "It was something that happened in Vietnam," but I said nothing more. Withdrew and ended up vaguely sad and, more than anything, guilty about that part of my life. I had never, in my marriage, said a word about Vietnam, the jungle, the stress, coming home, or the abuse I had received in Melbourne. Lynn knew I was a Vietnam veteran, and that was it. Years later, Lynn told me that every August she would do anything to avoid a confrontation, no matter how small. But the cracks were starting to show. I would experience debilitating wind pains and agonising bouts of diarrhoea. I was baffled. I had experienced this problem for almost 10 years and could never fathom its cause. I was a typical male and never dreamed of seeking medical advice. "Why do you always walk along the wall or the outside edge when we walk on busy footpaths?" my wife would ask. "What a stupid question," I thought. "Why do you sit in the corner or near a door when we go out? Or near the exit at a picture theatre?" God, I'd think she was so paranoid. Why couldn't she just leave me alone? In 1978, I graduated as a high school teacher. I was 33 years old. It had taken me 11 years to find a career and settle down. My first week at my new high school in a new suburb north of Perth was a classic. The fact that I wasn't suspended or sacked straight away was amazing. On my fifth day, I was in the lock area at lunchtime when a fight broke out just outside. Kids came from everywhere. 400 of them out of a school population of 600 were instantly watching the fight. They appeared thrilled with the spectacle. I raced into the centre of the mob, turned a rubbish bin upside down and jumped on top. I shouted with anger at them, feeling swelling rage and frustration flood my system. "Listen, you little arseholes," I said in a strong, loud, quite calm voice. The fight stopped immediately. "You disgust me," I said with narrowed eyes. "Mention the word fight and you run from everywhere in seconds. You chant, urge, and then claim to be humans. You must be bloody joking. Yet sound the friggin' school siren and you stroll to classes and arrive late. What are you, bloody animals?" There was a stunned silence. Nobody else spoke. "God help this world, if that's what motivates you. Piss off, the lot of you." Heads went down. A teacher standing nearby looked at me with astonished bewilderment as the large crowd dispersed. I knew immediately that I had overstepped the mark, as that enraged fear returned to my stomach. It heralded itself with nausea, ominous wind pains, and then a vice-like headache. I had a sudden, excruciating glimpse of myself as a loud, tactless moron. The siren sounded. Disillusioned, I walked up the stairs, thoughts rushing around in my head about resignation and trying to explain it to my wife. I gripped my painful stomach. My class were outside my room before I arrived. That was a first. During afternoon recess, there was a lot of whispering in the staff room and strange looks in my direction. At the final bell, with the students dismissed, a message came from the principal to report to his office immediately. I feared the worst. "Take a seat, Mr. Hurd." I had had 2 30-minute meetings with the principal before the beginning of the school year. He was direct, and I respected that. He struck me then as being very professional. "Mr. Hurd, I've been told by another teacher that you had a long, strong talk to our students." I hesitated. "Don't answer that," he interrupted before I could speak. "I believe your delivery in the locker area would have matched an address at a waterside workers' meeting. Whatever you said and how you said it is of little interest to me. All I know is that the teachers are abuzz. It's the first time all the students turned up for classes on time. The school has never been quieter. Mr. Hurd, two things have occurred. Somehow you've gained the students' respect. Secondly, half the teachers think you're a peace-loving, crazy idiot, and the other half believes you're a reformed megalomaniac thug they don't want to upset. Do something about your swearing, son." That was the start of a great relationship. Teaching became my life. After a few years of intensive effort, I found I was prepared for most lessons and began to have some spare time on my hands. Any normal man would have jumped at the chance to spend more time with his family, but I became obsessed with filling my spare time with demanding pursuits. I joined a marathon club and competed every weekend. I couldn't just run for fun, I had to have top times. I took on more study and had to have distinctions in all my subjects. Slowly, as time passed, I was becoming a robot. My students excelled, my academic results were excellent, and my running times were good. All this helped me not to look at my private life, which was shit. Our marriage was bumping along the bottom. My wife ran the family and held it together. I guess I loved them all, but I couldn't show it. I was devoid of emotion, a workaholic, and beginning to feel the first creeping symptoms of anxiety. Most nights I would sleep between 4 and 6 hours, and the nightmares were becoming common. My lips were covered in sores and rashes I'd had in Vietnam returned, and I sweated a lot. Finally, my wife insisted I get some help. I did. I had some counselling. I left satisfied that I had been cured, and announced this proudly to my wife. Of course, I didn't tell the psychologist about Vietnam, my nightmares, the terrifying anger, or the churning stomach pains. No way. They were nothing to do with it. When the 6th of August came around again, sometime in the 1980s, my efforts to smother my stress and anxiety were not working. I usually ran 10 kilometres after work, so I built it up to 15 kilometres, hoping I would fall asleep exhausted. It didn't work. And most nights, I would wake up sweating and screaming. I averaged 4 hours sleep at the most. My wife was very concerned and somewhat bewildered by my unstable behaviour. On the 6th of August, I drove to school early and put up the school flag at half-mast. I hoped it would be a quiet, busy day with no input from me, and that the students would just get on with the work I had set them. The first class lined up, as they usually do, and then walked quietly into the room. Out of my mouth, suddenly, came a completely unrehearsed statement. All of your work is on the blackboard. Please help one another quietly. Today is a very sad day for me. I have struggled to come to school. Thank you. I admit my eyes were probably teary as I spoke, but I would never have guessed the reactions. Those students were inspiring. Every class lined up and walked in quietly. I said nothing. Some students, as they left, said, "Thanks, Mr. Hurd." I was close to tears by my last class. I remembered with shame the foul-mouthed anger I'd displayed in my first week at the lockers. These were good kids. In the mid-1980s, I was posted to a country school north of Perth. One evening in 1987, I heard about the Welcome Home March on the news. It was being organised by Vietnam veterans in Sydney. "You should go, Baz," said Lynn. "No way. All that stuff was behind me." That was my blunt, automatic response. The local RSL offered to help pay the airfares for any local Vietnam veterans. In fact, the RAAF were flying vets from Perth. I still couldn't bring myself to make the trip. Instead, I sat and watched the march on the TV. My stomach felt heavy and my heart ached. I wanted to cry, but I couldn't. I recognised so many faces. Pigs from my battalion, my old unit. Sap in a wheelchair, blokes crying, hugging, backslapping and distressed diggers. People were waving flags, cheering, smiling, clapping and welcoming us home. When it was over, I sat bewildered. I had made a terrible mistake. I should have attended. I felt so alone and isolated. That night, I sat for hours in the dark and then walked aimlessly around the town, talking aloud to Cards, Booster and Blue and Stacker, and most of those blokes I remembered fondly but had never seen in many, many years. It had been decades since I'd even seen Knackers. The phone rang the following evening. It was Booster. "You slack prick turd, where were you?" He had taken 5 hours to find me. "Saturday night, the Chelsea RSL. Be there, you dopey bastard." I was stunned. It had been 20 years, but I knew that voice in an instant, automatically remembering Booster's operator call sign, 1-1. Lynn drove me to the airport, where I caught the plane for the 4-hour trip to Melbourne. Booster was waiting to pick me up. It is impossible to explain the warm, overwhelmed emotions that surged through me when I saw Knackers, Snoggins and Booster. We held hands, we hugged, we laughed, we traded insults, we were happy. I hadn't shown those emotions in 20 years. And then something remarkable happened. The conversations took a strange turn. "How do you handle the sound of a chopper? Did you have trouble settling down when you got home? Have you lost all your old schoolmates? Do you have flashbacks? Any rashes? How are your feet? Get upset when violence appears on the TV? Never marched on Anzac Day? Bastards. Pisspot or workaholic? Do you never mention Vietnam? Do you have the nightmares?" "We were all the same. All of us." Their wives nodded in unison. Why hadn't I thought to bring Lynn? Back home, she commented that every photo of my mates had us with our arms around each other, laughing and relaxing. She'd been married to me for years and never seen me like that. I looked at her and I knew it was true.